This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with The Week magazine of May 1st. Iran flexes its power over Strait of Hormuz. With peace talks between the U.S. and Iran at an impasse, the clash for control of the crucial Strait of Hormuz intensified as Iran seized at least two cargo ships in the trade corridor in retaliation for a U.S. naval blockade of its ports. The Navy has turned back some 30 ships trying to enter or exit Iranian ports since the blockade was imposed earlier in April, and in a bid to ramp up the economic pressure on Tehran, the U.S. boarded a tanker carrying Iranian oil in the Indian Ocean and seized an Iranian-flagged container ship that tried to run the blockade. The Iranian regime accused the U.S. of piracy and soon after seized two cargo ships, one flying a Panamanian flag, the other a Liberian flag, claiming the vessels had tried to navigate the contested strait without its approval. White House spokesperson Caroline Levitt said Iran's attacks on international vessels didn't constitute a violation of the U.S.-Iran ceasefire. A U.S. delegation led by Vice President J.D. Vance was set to travel to Pakistan for a second round of peace talks, but the trip was delayed after Iran refused to take part. A foreign ministry spokesman cited contradictory messages and inconsistent behavior from the Americans. Other Iranian officials cited the blockade, which the regime calls an act of war. Trump, who had warned that the military is raring to go for strikes on Iran if a deal wasn't reached before the temporary ceasefire ended, extended the truce indefinitely, saying Iran's leadership was fractured and needed time to come up with a unified proposal. Iranian officials accused Trump of trying to buy time for a surprise strike. With traffic at a standstill in the strait, which carried some 20% of the world's oil before the start of the war, U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright acknowledged that gas prices, now averaging about $4 a gallon, might not drop below $3 until next year. Trump said that's totally wrong and that prices will plummet as soon as this ends, a claim experts called unrealistic. Oil and gasoline rise very quickly and they come down very slowly, said economist Peter Earle. A new Quinnipiac poll found 65% of Americans blame Trump for the spike in gas prices, and more than half blame him a lot. As Trump's approval numbers plunge to the mid-30s, associates say he wants out of the increasingly unpopular war, said Barak Ravid in Axios. His negotiators suspect a peace deal is within reach, but that they may not have anyone in Tehran empowered to say yes. Hardline generals from the elite Revolutionary Guard now run the country, and they're openly at odds over strategy with Iran's civilian negotiators. The new supreme leader, Mojtaba Khamenei, could break the impasse, but he is rumored to have been badly wounded in the airstrike that killed his father, former Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, and is barely communicating. There's another major obstacle, said Elena Treen and Kevin Liptak in CNN.com. The Iranians don't trust Trump. The two sides seemed to be nearing an agreement. Then Trump went on a tear on social media and in interviews, falsely claiming Iran had agreed to a host of provisions that hadn't been finalized and had accepted the most contentious U.S. demands, such as handing over its stockpile of enriched uranium. That tanked the rising optimism for a deal, and it's unclear where peace talks go from here. Even Trump's most basic claims about the Iran war can't be trusted, said Daniel Dale, also in CNN.com. He said that Vance was en route to Islamabad. In fact, the Veep had never left the U.S., and he falsely claimed last week that Iran had agreed to never again close the Strait of Hormuz. Virtually nothing the president says can be taken at face value, a situation the world has never had to contend with. He's confounded not just negotiators, but ordinary Americans, said Peter Hamby in Puck. A new poll shows they have no idea why this war is happening, with answers ranging from keeping Iran from getting nukes, 22%, to taking oil, 20%, to a show of power, 13%. Control of the strait has become the strategic fulcrum of the war, said National Review in an editorial. Iran seems to think if it keeps the strait closed, it will exact so much economic pain that Trump will end his blockade or accept a deal that relents on his red lines. He needs to convince Tehran he's perfectly willing to start shooting again and take the strait back by force. Iran thinks it has the upper hand, said Erica Solomon in the New York Times. After a high-stakes game of chicken, it believes Trump blinked first when he extended the ceasefire with no concessions. That validates its view that Iran's readiness to absorb the economic pain wrought by the war exceeds Trump's. The regime sees this as an existential battle, and no matter how much suffering the blockade inflicts, experts say it's not going to blink. Both sides have powerful incentives to end this, so in a world of logic, a settlement would be a safe bet, said Mark Champion in Bloomberg. But we're in a realm where logic doesn't seem to apply, stuck with leaders who lack the personal and political courage needed for compromise. In Tehran, fanatical hardliners call the shots. In Washington, we have a president who seems to live in his own movie, reinventing reality to follow a script in which he plays the triumphant hero. It's an inherently unstable situation with no obvious way out, and a return to war looks all too possible. Lawmakers grill Kennedy over MAHA agenda. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. refused to commit to following vaccine guidance from the next CDC director as he appeared before Congress to justify his health policies over a series of grueling hearings. President Trump nominated Dr. Erica Schwartz, who served as Deputy Surgeon General in his first term, to lead a CDC reeling from Kennedy's staffing purge and vaccine schedule changes. Schwartz, a Navy veteran who is pro-vaccine, will need to clear a Senate confirmation hearing, but is widely viewed as qualified. But when Representative Raul Ruiz, Democrat of California, asked Kennedy whether he would implement whatever vaccine guidance Schwartz might issue without interference, the secretary said he was not going to make that kind of commitment. During his 7 days of answering senators' questions, Kennedy vigorously defended his Make America Healthy Again agenda. He insisted his criticism of vaccines had nothing to do with the measles outbreaks that killed 3 people last year. Stuck by his support for raw milk, which has led to E. coli outbreaks in 3 states, and called a study that refuted his purported link between autism and Tylenol use in pregnancy garbage. Challenged on his decision to cancel $500 million in mRNA vaccine research contracts, he said, COVID is gone and the mRNA vaccines have a limited efficacy against respiratory illnesses. In fact, COVID continues to spawn deadly variants. He did, however, concede that mRNA vaccines hold promise in treating some cancers. President Trump may finally be kicking out the crazy, said Noah Rothman in National Review. The nomination of the refreshingly competent Schwartz echoes the changes at Homeland Security, where Mark Wayne Mullen is restoring a sense of normalcy after the chaotic tenure of his predecessor, Kristi Noem. While Kennedy so far remains at his post, it appears the Trump administration is pivoting away from the fringes of American intellectual life to which it was once so attracted. Schwartz is a good pick, said Lisa Jarvis in Bloomberg. She certainly has the management and public health chops to lead the agency, but so did Susan Montaraz, the CDC's last full-time director, and Kennedy persuaded Trump to fire her within weeks, and Schwartz will be coming into a demoralized agency purged of thousands of its scientists its website brimming with diatribe rather than data. Will she have the mettle to stand up to Kennedy when he attempts to suppress or warp science? It will be tough, said Jonathan Cohn in the Bulwark. With midterm elections approaching, the White House knows Kennedy's anti-vaccine mania is a political loser, but it's an open question whether it is changing policy or just messaging. Kennedy's still in charge, after all, and it would take years to reverse the damage he's already done. It doesn't matter who you put in at CDC, said Deborah Howry, the agency's former chief medical officer, as long as the secretary continues to assert his influence. Congress, a new era of accountability after Swalwell? An ethics earthquake hit Congress, said Zachary Schirmely in USA Today, and it's only intensifying. The first tremor was the resignation of Representative Eric Swalwell, the seven-term California Democrat and a leading candidate to be the state's next governor, after he was accused of sexual assault and misconduct by multiple women. The married father of three says the accusations, including that he raped two women, are false and lies. Just hours after Swalwell quit, Representative Tony Gonzalez, Republican of Texas, who admitted an affair with a female aide who later died by suicide, also resigned. In both cases, a bipartisan coalition of female lawmakers had signaled they were moving toward expulsion votes. But this Me Too moment seems part of a broader reckoning. Representative Sheila Cherfilus McCormick, Democrat of Florida, resigned after the House Ethics Committee found her guilty of spending millions of COVID relief dollars on her 2022 election. And pressure is mounting on Representative Corey Mills, Republican of Florida, who's being investigated over allegations of domestic violence, revenge porn, and campaign finance violations. He denies any wrongdoing. Why is this happening now? Asked Joan Finocchi in the Boston Globe. Maybe it's a backlash to the Me Too backlash. Maybe it's our post-Epstein sensitivity to power and perversion. Whatever the reason, it's good for the country that Congress is policing itself and setting standards in a bipartisan way. Swalwell's exit was about politics, not decency, said Alicia Finley in the Wall Street Journal. Democrats knew for years that Swalwell was a sex pest, but they still cheered his relentless attacks on President Trump and nodded along as he declared during Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court confirmation hearings that sexual assault victims deserve to be heard. But when the allegations against him became public, Democrats turned on Swalwell in case he threw the California governor's race to a Republican. It's nice that other resignations have followed, said John Alsop in The New Yorker. But the careful scalp-for-scalp arithmetic carries an unseemly whiff of partisan horse trading. Is this a real crackdown on ugly behavior, or a choreographed effort to look like they're taking it seriously? The House's culture of turning a blind eye will be hard to shake, said Michelle Cottle in the New York Times. Yes, the Me Too movement scared some people straight for a while, but it didn't change the essential power dynamic on the Hill, where members drunk on flattery and self-regard routinely abuse the often young, often female staffers who work for them. For the ambitious Swalwell, that culture of sexual tolerance was as much of a draw as fame, power, and the other trappings of office, said Melanie Mason in Politico. A protege of former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Swalwell thought he was untouchable, until he wasn't. Republicans are in no position to moralize, said Christian Schneider in National Review, having handed their party to inveterate horndog Donald Trump. But Swalwell does represent a uniquely Democratic species of predator, the male feminist who trumpets his support for women as a prelude to making advances, then uses his progressivism as a cloak of invisibility when accountability looms. Swalwell, at least, has paid a price, and with criminal probes underway in New York and California, it could get higher, said Ingrid Jacques in USA Today. But until both parties stop recruiting creeps and criminals and voters start demanding better, the swamp of congressional ethics will remain a bipartisan problem. Shreveport, Louisiana, mass shooting. A Louisiana man killed 8 children, including 7 of his own, in the country's deadliest mass shooting in more than 2 years. Shreveport police said Shamar Elkins, 31, fatally shot the children, ages 3 to 11, execution style, using a pistol that worked like an assault-style weapon. He also shot his wife, who was hospitalized with life-threatening injuries, and the mother of 3 of his children in a house nearby. Another woman and a 12-year-old girl escaped the horrific scene by jumping off a roof. Elkins later died by gunshot after leading police on a car chase. Elkins's wife had recently told him she was seeking a divorce, and relatives say Elkins, an Army veteran, had checked into the local Veterans Affairs Hospital in January for a mental health evaluation, but he maintained a happy facade as a doting father, making the tragedy even harder to reconcile. It will be written in the pages of history as one of the worst days in Shreveport, said Police Chief Wayne Smith. Annandale, Virginia, murder-suicide. A former Virginia lieutenant governor, once considered a rising Democratic star, killed his wife before shooting himself in a murder-suicide. Justin Fairfax, 47, was going through a contentious divorce from 49-year-old Serena Fairfax when he fatally shot her in the basement of their Annandale, Virginia home while their 2 teenage children were present. He then went into his bedroom and turned his handgun on himself. Sexual assault allegations ended Fairfax's political career in 2019, and he and his wife separated in 2024. A judge recently granted Serena primary custody and ordered Fairfax to move out of the family's home by the end of April. Serena testified about Fairfax's heavy daily alcohol use, and acquaintances said he never got over the 2019 allegations, which he adamantly denied. Court records show that Banks had been trying to recover tens of thousands of dollars he owed. Washington, D.C., resignation. Another Trump cabinet member departed in scandal as Labor Secretary Lori Chavez de Remer resigned her post amid a growing number of misconduct allegations. The Labor Department's Inspector General was looking into whether she pursued a romantic relationship with a subordinate, a member of her security detail, while employees had lodged a formal office discrimination complaint alleging Chavez de Remer created a toxic workplace. Her husband, who was barred from entering the department's headquarters after being accused of sexual assault, frequently exchanged text messages with young female staff members, the New York Times reported, and Chavez de Remer instructed some of the women to pay attention to her husband and father. Her chief of staff and deputy chief of staff were placed on leave after being accused of concocting official trips so the secretary could vacation with friends. The former Oregon congresswoman has denied the allegations. She's the 3rd female cabinet member to exit this year. Miami, DeGenova returns. The Justice Department installed a familiar Trump loyalist, the president's former campaign lawyer, Joseph DeGenova, to lead a sprawling inquiry into Trump's enemies, replacing a career prosecutor who had expressed doubts about the criminal investigation into former CIA Director John Brennan. The 81-year-old DeGenova will head up the grand conspiracy probe tasked with investigating whether former federal officials committed crimes in investigating Trump. DeGenova, who backed the president's efforts to overturn the 2020 election results, is expected to split time between Miami and Fort Pierce, Florida, where a grand jury can be overseen by federal judge Aileen Cannon, who has issued favorable rulings for Trump. So far, though, Trump's vengeance campaign is not off to a great start. Prosecutors abruptly rescinded a subpoena just days after it was issued to Trump critic Brennan by DeGenova's predecessor Maria Medeiros Long, who was removed from the case Mexico City, secret CIA mission. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum demanded an explanation after two U.S. and two Mexican officials were killed in a car crash in Chihuahua, apparently while returning from a secret operation to destroy drug labs. Sheinbaum has said that Mexico will cooperate with the U.S. on intelligence sharing, but won't allow U.S. boots on the ground. Any such collaboration between the U.S. and Mexican local law enforcement without federal permission, she said, would be a violation of Mexican law. To make matters worse, the two Americans were CIA officers, the New York Times reported. Chihuahua state officials said Mexican officers destroyed the lab on their own and only picked up the Americans, who were in the country to train the Mexicans in drone surveillance, afterward. Brussels, aid to Ukraine. With the pro-Russian Viktor Orban soon to lose power in Hungary, the European Union was able to approve a long-delayed $106 billion loan to Ukraine. Orban had held up the money because he claimed Ukraine was slow-walking repairs to a pipeline that brings Russian oil through Ukraine to Hungary. But after Orban lost the Hungarian election to the pro-EU Peter Magyar, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky abruptly changed his tune and said the pipeline was ready to go. Ukraine has completed repair work, Zelensky said. The pipeline can resume operation. Orban then said he would lift his veto of the loan. Russian spokesman Dmitry Peskov called Zelensky's behavior blackmail. Kyiv mass shooting. A 58-year-old Moscow native killed six people and wounded several more in Kyiv in the worst non-military mass shooting Ukraine has seen in years. Dmitry Vaslchenkov killed four people on the street, then barricaded himself inside a convenience store, taking employees and customers hostage. Negotiators tried for 40 minutes to persuade him to surrender. Then a SWAT team stormed in and killed him. Ukrainian authorities are treating the attack as an act of terrorism. They said Vaslchenkov has been living in Kyiv after moving from eastern Donetsk, a region mostly occupied by Russia. Neighbors in his apartment building said he seemed perfectly harmless. You'd never guess he was some kind of criminal, said Hanna Kuliuk, 75. Malabo, Equatorial Guinea. Pope's Truth to Power. Pope Leo XIV ended his 11-day Africa trip by telling Catholics in Equatorial Guinea that humanity's future risked being tragically compromised by wars and crumbling international law. Leo visited four countries, Algeria, Cameroon, Angola, and Equatorial Guinea, inspiring the faithful and lecturing on the dangers of greed and the lust for power. His forceful speeches were widely interpreted as targeting corrupt leaders in Africa as well as President Trump, who has clashed with him over immigration and the Iran war. In Algeria, the first Augustinian pope paid tribute to Saint Augustine, who was born there in AD 354. In Cameroon, Leo called for breaking the chains of corruption as President Paul Biya, who has been in power for 43 years, listened passively. Hearts must be set free, Leo said, from an idolatrous thirst for profit. People. Chase's mother issues. The Sopranos was a deeply personal work for David Chase, said Stuart Heritage in The Guardian. Its premise, Tony Soprano, a mob boss, goes into therapy to deal with the trauma caused by his emotionally abusive mother, was inspired by the writer and producer's relationship with his own paranoid and narcissistic mother. I portrayed her as she was, says Chase, 80. Unlike Tony's mom, Norma Chase didn't try to have her son killed. But in 1967, at the height of the Vietnam War, my mother said, "I'd rather see you dead than avoid the draft." How did he take that? He laughs, "Not well. I had to create a whole TV series to get over it." Chase also had a tricky relationship with James Gandolfini, who played Tony. Gandolfini once called him Satan. He would sometimes go missing for days at a time during filming, struggling with the darkness of his character. Chase recalls three or four occasions when Gandolfini asked to meet because he was so unhappy, and they talked and talked and talked. But he says Gandolfini never refused to do anything, and that his disruptive behavior was trivial compared with that of the lead actors on Northern Exposure. When he joined that show as a writer in 1993, Chase found an assistant director measuring the distance from the two stars' trailers to the set because neither one wanted to have a longer walk than the other. Now that wasn't a happy set. A rising threat from ticks. Alpha-gal syndrome, which can trigger a potentially fatal meat allergy, is surging across the U.S. Why? What causes alpha-gal syndrome? It often begins with a bite from a lone star tick, which has a sugar molecule known as alpha-gal in its saliva. That molecule is found in the tissues of most mammals but not humans, and normally causes no problems when people consume it in red meat. But when alpha-gal enters the bloodstream via a tick bite, the body produces antibodies to fight the intruder. In about 50% of people with those antibodies, a subsequent exposure to alpha-gal, such as by eating beef, lamb, pork, or venison, can spark an overactive immune response that causes hives, joint pain, vomiting, and severe abdominal cramps. It was a terrifying experience, said Roanoke, Virginia resident Heather O'Brien, who in 2019 found herself struggling to breathe after eating a pork sausage. I didn't know I had an allergy, but it almost killed me. In extreme cases, alpha-gal syndrome, AGS, can cause anaphylactic shock and death. The U.S. confirmed its first alpha-gal death in November, a 47-year-old New Jersey airline pilot who collapsed in 2024, 4 hours after eating a burger at a barbecue. Thousands of people are now diagnosed with AGS each year, a remarkable number considering the syndrome was formally identified only in 2007. Alpha-gal has gone from a medical curiosity to a major public health issue in just a decade, said Vinay Jakaradar, a gastroenterologist at Virginia Commonwealth University. How many people have AGS? More than 110,000 suspected cases were identified from 2010 to 2022, according to the Centers for Disease Control, which estimates that up to 450,000 people may be affected. Some doctors believe that's an undercount. A study co-authored by Jahagirdar found a 100-fold increase in positive tests for alpha-gal antibodies between 2013 and 2024. Once clustered in the southeast, the traditional habitat of the Lone Star tick, the disease is now common across the northeast and midwest and is surging along with other tick-borne conditions such as Lyme disease. Scientists say the warming climate has allowed Lone Star ticks to move north to areas where it was previously too cold for the species to thrive. The parasites have also been aided by the booming population of white-tailed deer, their primary host. Lone Star ticks are especially aggressive and move three times as fast as the black-legged tick. "They will hunt you," said Sharon Pitcairn Forsyth, a conservationist and founder of the Alpha-Gal Alliance. "They are like a cross between a lentil and a velociraptor." What are the signs of infection? There aren't any, so most people don't know they have AGS until they suffer an allergic reaction. But getting a diagnosis can be a long journey, both because many doctors aren't familiar with alpha-gal and because symptoms can take up to 6 hours to appear after an exposure. Andrew Keenan, 58, a telecoms repairman in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, woke up with severe stomach cramps at 2 a.m. after a skirt steak dinner. He then broke out in hives, and his blood pressure fell so low that I sat up in bed and almost fainted. Keenan, who was treated at the hospital for anaphylactic shock, now gets cramps and itching that can last days when he accidentally consumes alpha-gal. But reactions vary widely. Some are allergic to pork, but not beef, or vice versa. Some react to dairy, some don't. Reactions are consistently inconsistent, said Patrick Roden Reynolds, a biologist who studies tick-borne diseases. Is there a treatment? No. The only way to manage the disease is to avoid alpha-gal, which is trickier than just ordering halibut instead of lamb chops at a restaurant. Food can easily be cross-contaminated, and aerosolized fat molecules from sizzling meat can cause a reaction, as can many items with mammal-derived ingredients, dairy products, food with gelatin, medications made with glycerin, personal care products that contain collagen or lanolin, even sugar, which is processed with animal bone char. I'm nervous about everything I eat, said Jamie Ridgway, a Virginia Beach resident who landed in the ER after eating a marshmallow. Some sufferers now avoid restaurants and dinner invites. You don't want to be the social pariah asking people, is this vegan? What about that? Said Massachusetts teacher Kate Sudarsky, 26. How do people cope with AGS? Support groups are growing in hard-hit areas. O'Brien of Roanoke reports an almost constant stream of new members of the online groups she's joined. In high-incidence states like Virginia, where up to 1 in 50 residents of some counties has AGS, a growing number of restaurants offer alpha-gal-free dishes. Some eateries have gone completely alpha-gal-free, said Pitcairn Forsyth, who notes a lot of chefs have AGS. Many sufferers carry EpiPens to treat severe reactions. They include Missourian Annie Kittrell Poline, who at home now has separate pots and pans and cutting boards. I have my own barbecue grill. We have two ovens. What are health authorities doing? A growing number of states track cases. 12 now mandate reporting of positive tests, including Kentucky, Virginia, and Massachusetts. Health officials are trying to raise awareness of the condition and to educate people on how to avoid tick bites. Meanwhile, researchers are attempting to solve a number of mysteries, including the reason reactions vary so widely, why the allergy sometimes fades over time, and whether people who carry alpha-gal antibodies but show no visible allergic response might suffer unseen health effects, including digestive problems or coronary disease. Treatment breakthroughs may be on the way, but in the meantime, experts expect AGS to keep spreading. It seems like an oddity now, said Brandon Hollingsworth, a University of South Carolina epidemiologist, but we could end up with millions of people with an allergy to meat. Best columns of the U.S. Thomas's Holy War on Progressives. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas is sounding the alarm. Progressives are an existential threat, said Heather Digby Parton in Salon. At a speech at the University of Texas at Austin, Thomas made it clear he's no umpire making dispassionate decisions about the Constitution and the rule of law. Instead, he spoke as a theocrat who believes that Americans should be governed by natural law with rights given by God, as defined by conservatives like him. His speech was a diatribe against the progressive movement, tracing it back to its origins at the turn of the 20th century, when it arose in response to the monopolies and capitalistic excesses of the Gilded Age. Thomas, however, portrayed the movement as sinister and anti-American. In Thomas's telling, progressivism enabled the growth of government, crushed individual rights, and caused nearly all the ills of the 20th century. In a jaw-dropping statement, Thomas declared it is not possible for America and progressivism to coexist forever. He made it clear that he believes that the country is at war and that his side is aligned with God. That extremist belief is the foundation of every one of his Supreme Court opinions. FBI, is Patel a national security threat? Kash Patel has never been qualified to lead the FBI, said Danielle Hahn in Jezebel, and The Atlantic just showed us the gazillionth reason why. In a damning report, the magazine alleged that the Bureau's director suffers paranoid freakouts about being fired, is often absent from work, and is regularly too drunk to do his job. Justice Department and White House sources told The Atlantic that Patel's security detail has repeatedly struggled to wake the seemingly hungover FBI boss, forcing meetings and briefings to be rescheduled for later in the day. Last year, his detail even reportedly considered using SWAT-style breaching equipment because Patel had been unreachable behind locked doors. Some FBI and administration officials wonder if alcohol explains Patel's repeated missteps, such as his sharing of inaccurate information about a suspect following the September murder of Charlie Kirk, and fear that he's become a national security risk. Patel vehemently denies all the accusations and filed a $250 million defamation lawsuit against The Atlantic, calling its report hit piece lies. Patel's goal, of course, isn't actually to win in court, said William Crystal in The Bulwark. To do that, he'd have to prove not only that the claims in The Atlantic were false, but also that the outlet knew they were so when it published them, or at least didn't care if they were true or not. His real aim is to punish a publication that dared embarrass him with a costly nuisance suit and to demonstrate to an audience of one, President Trump, that he's fighting the lying lib media. For now, Patel still has support from the White House, said Mike Pesca in his Substack newsletter. Trump appreciates his willingness to target perceived enemies, Patel vowed that arrests related to the 2020 election are coming soon, and to purge anyone who is anything less than loyal to the president, including scores of FBI agents over the past year. It's possible the Atlantic expose will doom Patel, said Jeet here in The Nation. Trump, a teetotaler who watched his older brother drink himself to death, cannot abide substance abuse in his underlings. But whatever happens with Patel, the damage he's wreaked will outlive his tenure. He has gutted FBI teams focused on terrorism, political corruption, and organized crime, and turned the Bureau into a dangerously right-wing agency with the power to hurt the president's political foes. The real problem is not Patel's alleged inebriation, but the deep corruption of the most important law enforcement agency in the country. Health and Science, spring cleaning for the brain. Put down your phone for 2 weeks and you could reverse a decade's worth of cognitive decline. That's the finding of one of the largest studies of its kind involving more than 450 people, reports the Washington Post. For 14 days, the participants used an app called Freedom to block internet access on their phones. Calls and texts were still allowed. Their daily time online plummeted from more than 5 hours to just 2.5, and by the end of the period, participants showed marked improvement in sustained attention, mental health, and well-being. The gain in attention was equivalent to about 10 years of age-related decline, and the effect on depression symptoms was comparable to that of cognitive behavioral therapy. Encouragingly, even those who cheated by borrowing a phone still benefited, and many reported that the positive effects lingered well after the experiment ended. The findings echo those of a separate Harvard study, which found that just a week of reduced smartphone use produced drops in anxiety, depression, and insomnia. Phone use is far more damaging than computer use, the researchers say, because it tends to be compulsive and mindless. People scroll while walking, eating, and talking, making those activities less satisfying and relationships less fulfilling. You don't have to restrict yourself forever, says co-author Konstantin Kushlev from Georgetown University. Even a partial digital detox, even for a few days, seems to work. Misdiagnosing vegetative state. As many as 1 in 4 patients diagnosed as being in a vegetative state may actually be conscious, trapped inside unresponsive bodies but aware and listening, reports the New York Times. A landmark study examined 241 patients across multiple countries, all of whom appeared unresponsive during standard bedside exams. But when given advanced brain scans and asked to perform mental tasks, such as imagining playing tennis, a quarter showed brain activity indicating they understood and could follow commands. Scientists call this cognitive motor dissociation a disconnect between a semi-conscious mind and an immobile body. By some estimates, 50,000 Americans have been classified as in a chronic vegetative state, with up to 400,000 more minimally conscious. If the study's ratio holds, tens of thousands of those people, many living in continuous care facilities, may be aware enough to be in pain. Yet, testing for that type of consciousness is available only in a few clinics and is the standard of care nowhere. Bedside exams are highly unreliable. Studies of those suggest up to 40% of vegetative state diagnoses may be wrong. It's not okay, said neurologist Nicholas Schiff, to know this and do nothing. Streaming tips, new documentaries. Mr. Nobody Against Putin. This year's Oscar winner for Best Documentary takes viewers inside a school in small-town Russia, where students are blitzed with propaganda about the war in Ukraine, and one teacher, Pavel Talankin, refuses to go along. $6 on demand. Sky King. This edge-of-your-seat documentary revisits the event that made Richard Bebo Russell an internet folk hero. In 2019, the young airport ground service agent stole an empty passenger jet and, despite having no piloting experience, flew it solo for 70 minutes, chatting nonstop with ground control before fatally crashing into an island on Puget Sound. Hulu. Modern Whore. Former escort and stripper Andrea Werhun aims to erase the stigma associated with such work by sharing anecdotes about her experiences and participating in lighthearted reenactments, recreating the spirit of her 2017 memoir. Available to rent May 1st. Beam Me Up, Sulu. In the 1980s, Star Trek fan Stan Wu persuaded George Takei to reprise his series character, Sulu, for a low-budget short. Footage from that project and interviews with Takei and others produced an endearing look at Star Trek's impact on small-screen minority representation. $6 on demand. 4x20 quick hits. Spark Up, if you're so inclined, for this collection of 4 short documentaries celebrating aspects of cannabis culture, including the making of Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle and the long, defiant run of High Times magazine. Hulu. The AI documentary. Navalny director Daniel Roher has made the primer on artificial intelligence we all need. Talking with scientists and tech CEOs, he quickly finds the horror, but he also finds hope. Maybe, just maybe, AI can make the world a better place. $20 on demand. Warsh, Senators Grill Fed Chair nominee. Kevin Warsh, President Trump's nominee to lead the Federal Reserve, faced questions from senators who seemed skeptical about his independence, said Nick Timiraos in the Wall Street Journal. Warsh, a former Fed governor, spent much of his confirmation hearing insisting that the central bank will maintain its autonomy from a president who demands lower interest rates. He also outlined a sweeping agenda that would break from the Fed's recent approach by holding fewer news conferences and slashing the bank's bloated balance sheet. Senator Tom Tillis, Republican of North Carolina, vowed again to block Warsh unless the Justice Department ends its criminal investigation of Fed Chair Jerome Powell, though he said he would consider rescinding his objection if Congress launched a review. Warsh had an opportunity to prove himself, said Catherine Rampell in The Bulwark, and he failed. He was asked two pointed questions. First, whether he would defend Fed Governor Lisa Cook, as Powell has done, after Trump fired her on unsubstantiated grounds. Second, whether the criminal charges against Powell are bogus pretexts for disagreements over the Fed's interest rate policy. Warsh refused to answer either question, saying that he lacks the legal expertise to weigh in. It's never been a question whether Warsh has the brains for the job. It's whether he has the spine for it. Clearly, he doesn't. Spirit Airlines seeking a government bailout. Spirit Airlines is scrambling to stave off a financial crash, said Allison Sider and Brian Schwartz in the Wall Street Journal. The budget airline has filed for bankruptcy twice since its planned merger with JetBlue was blocked by regulators in 2024, and rising jet fuel costs since the start of the Iran war have taken an added toll. President Trump said he'd like to see a buyer emerge for Spirit. When the week went to press, the administration was discussing lending the carrier as much as $500 million in exchange for a significant stake. Refunds, a happy tax day for more Americans. April 15th is typically a day Americans want to forget. Not this year, said Julie Z. Weil in the Washington Post. Thanks to the big, beautiful bill passed by congressional Republicans last year, taxpayers were able to claim an average of $3,462 in tax refunds as of tax day, up nearly 11% from 2025. Over $241 billion has been refunded to Americans so far, compared with $211 billion at this time last year. That's a result of language in the GOP law that increased the standard deduction, added a $6,000 rebate for qualifying seniors, boosted the child tax deduction, and set new rules for deducting tips, overtime, and car loan payments. The bill also overrode planned tax increases for a vast majority of filers. People have taken notice. Aliyah Shawa, a waitress at a New York City restaurant, said that she and her husband, a chef, got a whopping $26,000 refund after deducting the taxes on her tips and his car loan, compared with owing $12,000 to the IRS last year. I finally get something back, Shawa said. People are using their refunds to shore up their finances rather than splurge, said Julia Fonzeres and Josiana Joshua in Bloomberg. Early filers increased debt payments by about 20%, according to the Bank of America Institute, using the funds to pay off bills, car loans, credit card balances, and student loans. Lower-income households put even more of their refunds, nearly 30%, toward repaying debts. At a time of stubborn inflation and rising gas prices because of the war with Iran, Americans are focused on getting their own fiscal homes in order. That's why the refund boost isn't likely to improve voters' sour mood, said Daniel Bunn in Barron's. The average refund is only about $350 more than last year, which is well below what President Trump originally claimed it would be, and an extra few hundred dollars landing in Americans' wallets from once-a-year tax refunds won't ease the economic strain caused by many of Trump's other policies, including his tariffs and cuts to Obamacare. The reality is that on tax day 2026, the cost of day-to-day life was higher and more financially tenuous than it was a year prior. Besides bigger refunds, there's another thing that's different this tax season, said Richard Rubin in the Wall Street Journal, a lack of enforcement. The IRS has shed more than 25,000 workers since last year, leaving fewer federal employees to audit returns, collect unpaid tax debts, and deter Americans from skirting the law. At the top, there's no acting IRS commissioner, and senior officials are doing double duty. Audits of people with at least $10 million are set to drop 39% this year. The Trump administration has defunded the police, said one tax lawyer. There's no more succinct way to describe what's happened. Cook. What his departure means for Apple. Tim Cook's reign as the greatest non-founder CEO of all time is coming to an end, said Ben Thompson in Stratechery. The Apple boss announced that he will step down in September and hand off the world's third largest company by market value to John Ternus, Apple's senior vice president of hardware engineering. It concludes an incredible run by Cook, who inherited the job from Apple founder Steve Jobs in 2011. Unlike his visionary and artistic predecessor, Cook was, without a question, an operational genius who took Jobs' signature creation, the iPhone, and brought it to an unimaginable scale. Apple's profits grew by 354%, driven largely by Cook's success in growing the App Store, which helped Apple become the first public company worth $1 trillion. His announcement comes on a high note, too, after Apple's best ever quarter financially, with revenue up 16% from a year prior and the company now worth $4 trillion. The elevation of Ternus feels like a safe choice, said Reed Albergati in Semaphore. Apple isn't about to roll the dice on someone who might squander its lucrative business, so it chose a company lifer hailing from the Jobs era and not some AI guru wanting a radical new direction. It says that Apple views itself as a hardware company and it's going with the hardware guy, said Dave Lee in Bloomberg. Under Cook, the company maintained its competence and composure, while rivals chased the next big thing, be it the metaverse, drones, self-driving cars, or artificial intelligence. His legacy is assured with a decades-long head start on what it takes to manufacture billions of units at an unparalleled high quality. It has further entrenched a fantastic hardware ecosystem, including the beloved AirPods and Apple Watch, through which it can incorporate a future of ambient computing where screens play less of a role. That's an enormous risk, said Peter Kafka in Business Insider. Apple may end up wishing it had a leader who wanted to take big, ambitious swings and did not opt out of the AI wave. The company's approach is just to let everyone else clobber each other to produce the best AI products, and it will sit back and collect some kind of rent when those competitors need to reach billions of iPhone users. But that's presuming that the iPhone is still relevant in 10 years. More and more people in Silicon Valley think AI will eventually be so powerful that it's going to create a new piece of tech that replaces the smartphone, leaving Apple without its core. To retain its standing among big tech big shots, Apple will need to think a little more different, said Dan Gallagher in the Wall Street Journal. Apple's stock has trailed nearly every other mega cap tech name since the launch of ChatGPT in 2022, with rivals like Nvidia and Alphabet now holding significantly more value. It may not be spending hundreds of billions of dollars to build up supercharged AI networks, but it needs to prove it has some foothold in the technology. Successfully launching a greatly improved Siri voice assistant would be a start, but what exactly Apple will be in the age of AI remains to be seen. Live Nation got what it deserved. The Live Nation verdict looks terrible for the Trump administration, said Helene Olin in MS.now. A federal jury in New York found that the concert giant, which owns Ticketmaster, maintained an illegal monopoly over entertainment venue ticket sales, harming customers and concert promoters alike. But according to the Trump administration, there's nothing to see here. Trump's Department of Justice tried to end the case early, stunning the presiding judge by agreeing to a surprise settlement that slapped Live Nation on the wrist with a $280 million fine. Attorneys general for 33 states and the District of Columbia refused to join the settlement and continued to pursue a jury verdict. It's a good thing they did, because the jury sided with the glaring evidence that Live Nation repeatedly, blatantly violated the anti-competitive agreement it signed when it acquired Ticketmaster, heaped endless fees on customers, threatened venues that didn't use Ticketmaster, and laughed as they were robbing them blind, baby. The actual words of a text message sent by an executive. It's unclear whether this decision will result in Live Nation's breakup, a remedy New York Attorney General Letitia James said states are seeking. Still, the millions of Americans tired of being beaten up by big business should be grateful. Random acts of flowers. After a near-fatal accident, Larson J. said one of the things that helped him most during his recovery was getting flowers delivered. So in 2008, he founded Random Acts of Flowers, randomactsofflowers.org, a nonprofit based in Knoxville, Tennessee, that brings bouquets of recycled flowers to people in hospitals and healthcare facilities around the country. Volunteers collect donated flowers from individuals as well as from businesses as grocery stores, funeral homes, and event venues. They trim, water, and arrange the flowers, creating bouquets that get delivered to those who need a pick-me-up in hospitals, nursing homes, and more, all within 48 hours. The final touch is a delivery card in each arrangement that details the name of the donor, sponsor, or person who created the bouquet. The nonprofit also organizes group activities for volunteers, including composting, as well as drives to collect donated vases. This is Jude Costello, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.